Hello and welcome back to the Back in My Play podcast. This is episode number 5, and we're here to talk about two games this week: Castlevania for the Nintendo Entertainment System and Streets of Rage 2 for the Sega Genesis or Mega Drive, depending on your region. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me this week, as always, is first off Josh Hillier. I thought you could get to go first this week, Josh.
It's a real honor, and I just want to say that there's a castle in the city I live in currently, and I want to go explore it with a whip.
I love it. This is a good trend. I like it. We're going to continue it this week. And also, we have, of course, Trey Gibson, who is in a brand new house.
Woo! Yes.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations. Yes.
Are you going to explore it with a whip?
Going to the attic.
Yeah. I think I'm going to give it a shot. It's not, you know, big enough to really find anything, but, you know, we'll give it a shot.
You never know.
Spiders.
There might be a bat hanging out in the attic. I don't know.
Yeah,
for sure. So, like I said, we're here to talk about not one but two games this week. First off, Castlevania, and then what we are, I guess, calling the mini boss, which is going to be Streets of Rage 2. And to give you a heads up, basically with the mini boss, what we're trying to do is focus on a game that, you know, we might not be able to fill an hour and a half with, but we could absolutely fill like 30 to 45 minutes with. And we, you know, still want to hit on these games because, again, we have fantastic memories of them, or they're games that we want to go back to because we never really got to sink our teeth into them back in the day. So, like I said, the first game that we're going to be talking about this week is Castlevania, and I'm going to give you a brief rundown of some history with that game. First off, it came out in Japan originally in 1986 on the Famicom Disk System, and when it was actually released on the Famicom Disk System, the title was not Castlevania, but instead Devil's Castle Dracula. That is the translation. And then it was eventually released in the United States in 1987. And if you're around at that time period, you might remember that was like at the start of the chip shortage, where a lot of games weren't readily available and Castlevania was really hard to find. But hopefully you were able to pick up a copy. It was developed and published by Konami under the Konami name. It wasn't, you know, under its what was it? Ultra Games was not an Ultra Games joint. And it consists of 18 stages. In early installments, I wanted to mention of Castlevania, the localization was kind of weird, where when it came over to the United States, like they took out some of the violence, some like things like nudity and imagery and paintings and religious imagery. And I always thought that was kind of weird because it was okay in Japan, but when it came over to the United States, I guess because, you know, predominantly the population, you know, due to like religious factors or something like that, they decided to censor that. And the key member that we're going to be hitting on for Castlevania is, you know, who would have believed this, but the music composer, which is Kinuyo Yamashita. And this is an interesting thing because this was a female music composer and obviously a heavily male-dominated industry at the time. And it was her very first game that she worked on. And she went to work on, you know, some decent games later on. But then, like, in the last 10 years, she's worked on, like, some terrible games. But I guess they must have had great music. So I guess there's that. So that's it for the history segment. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with our first segment, where we're going to go back to 1987 and talk about our history with the game. So stick around. Thank you. Okay, so again, best part about this show is we get to travel back in time every single week. So we're going to get into the TARDIS this week. That's our vehicle of choice. And we're going to be going back to 1987 when Castlevania was released on the Nintendo Entertainment System. And again, that's where we're focusing on because we are Americans and that's what we experience. So again, let's kind of go around. When was the first time that you got wind of this game, Josh?
Well, it came out when I was 3 years old, and I didn't have an NES at the time. But a couple of years later, once I received an NES, I went to the rental store. I'm always talking about the rental store, and saw that box art and was like, this looks really creepy. And even at that age, I was into creepy stuff. So I wanted to play it. I wanted to be afraid of it. And some of the kids I knew at school would talk about how they were afraid to play it. And so that was sort of like the big thing was, this Castlevania game. Have you played it? It's really weird. It's really creepy. There's monsters in it and all that. The music is kind of foreboding sounding. And so there were other kids I knew who wouldn't even play it due to that. But I was all over it because it had platforming elements, and I was big into platformers. It had that atmosphere. And so I think I rented it several times. And perhaps I shouldn't have been allowed to rent it at that age, but lo and behold, I rented it several times and became a lifelong Castlevania fan right away.
Trey, how about you? When was the first time that you saw and heard about Castlevania?
I want to say I was like 4 or 5. My dad actually bought a bunch of games from somebody he knew, and Castlevania was one of them. He had never played it before, and I had never played it before, and we sat down and played together, and he was terrible at it.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. He couldn't beat the giant bat at the end of the first level, and I remember I beat the bat before he did, and he was very upset with me. But I don't think he ever beat that game, and I never beat it. Back when I played it then, it was several years later before I managed to beat it once. But it was a very difficult game. It was very challenging, and I thought, really cool. Obviously, soundtrack sticks out to you. It's really catchy music, as most of the stuff back in the day was. But, it was a great game for its challenge. But, back when I played it then, I didn't get very far. So it was difficult for me back then. It still is to this day. But I want to say I was around 4 or 5 when we got it.
Yeah, so. So it would have been nice with some passwords so you could start at a later level.
Yeah, it would have been nice to be able to jump around, but that first level I learned it pretty well. I'd get past the bat, and then the second level I would just fall apart.
Josh, like you, I got it from my local rental store after seeing it in the official Nintendo Player's Guide that came out in 1987. There was some coverage in there, and it was a game that just looked super cool, and the box art is something that we talked about last time with Journey to Silius, or 2 times ago. And the cool thing about this game is that the box art was something that was kind of like a selling factor. You saw it, and it was a little bit unique. You saw a guy kind of standing in front of a gigantic castle, and you just like it screamed adventure, and it screamed like, oh my God, there's this huge quest this guy has to go on, and it was very appealing to the eyes. And
well, that's a good observation, because it really did give that, it exuded scale, like you're going to make your way to this castle eventually.
Yeah, it's one man versus the castle.
Yeah, you, He-Man.
Yeah, for sure. And again, I kind of have a similar story like you, Josh, where I went in and I rented it, and I brought it home, and I must have been 4 or 5 years old, and my brother was playing it, and I was kind of watching, and it scared the crap out of me, so much to the point where my mom walked in and saw me being scared by it, and she immediately took us in the car. We brought it back to the Popcorn Video in Beverly, Massachusetts, and had to swap it out for a different game, because she was not letting that be played in our household.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I mean, that was like, I got a couple minutes with it, and then I really never experienced the game again until, you know, maybe another 10 years, you know, 15 years later, when I started getting back into like collecting or going back and checking out NES games. It never was one of those games that I bought later when I grew up. So I didn't have memories of the music. I didn't have memories, things like that. I just remember like really digging the power-ups in the game and just seeing that, man, you get power-ups like immediately in the game. Like you get an axe that you can use and like, fling out immediately in the game. You always are constantly getting items. And that was kind of appealing, like, hitting the candles with your whip and being able to constantly get items. I thought that was, like, great to always be getting power-ups. I don't know. It's kind of like, it's one of those things, you know, you get a great sound effect with it, and it means, like, you know, something good's happening. It's one of those just kind of subconscious things, I guess. And, you know, for me, I always kind of dabbled in the franchise going throughout, like, life. Like, I would always... like I would check out Super Castlevania, and I checked out Symphony of the Night, and I checked out some of the Game Boy games, and I think we even had Castlevania Adventure for the Game Boy. Somehow that was okay to get. And the weird thing with it is I never like would go past like the first or second level. It just didn't grab me. It didn't sink its teeth into me like some other games, like a Mega Man and things like that. And it might have been the difficulty level at the time, but it seemed impenetrable. I just couldn't, it wasn't a game that I could play, and it might be another reason why I never went back to it until kind of, you know, the last couple of years, because I never thought I was skilled enough to be able to play through it.
Yeah, and it's truly hard. One thing I just wanted to say is collecting the hearts and, you know, being rewarded for that. As a kid, I distinctly remember this, is getting those hearts and thinking that I was getting health. A heart is sort of a universal sign in video games of health, and not realizing that that was actually building my item ability, and then being very confused when I would die because I was like, I just got all these hearts. I even got a big heart. Like, what
that
happened?
That was a pretty common misconception with that game. I remember thinking that too.
I think it happens to me every time I play a Castlevania game still.
Well, you know me. You know me in Zelda games. So when I see a heart, I'm like, ooh, life. Yes.
That's right. No. Build up that stamina, life bar.
Yeah. So.
That's totally weird because the second game in the series, hearts aren't even for items. They're for currency. Like it's... They kind of mess around with that stuff. And even in Japan, like a weird anecdote is that they... like they weren't always called like the same series. It wasn't always like the Castlevania series. They even changed the name around between like the first and the second one, and then back to, you know, kind of like Castle Dracula for the third one again. Just because obviously the second one doesn't take place really in the castle to start off with. You start off in a town. So, I mean, it was, you know, just an anecdote for you guys out there. But I think that might wrap it up. Is there any other really early memories that you guys have of Castlevania? Again, it was one of those games that seemed to get marketed the hell out of in Nintendo Power. Like there was tons of tips and tricks and strategies in Nintendo Power for that thing. Like it was always in the counselor's corner because it was super hard and people still had trouble with it. You know, even once they, I guess, were a little bit older, they just kept going back to that game. I swear to God, for like 2 years in Nintendo Power, you'd still see, you know, tips and tricks for Castlevania.
You know, it was a testament to people caring about it, you know, and still wanting to play it and still struggling with it, and sort of how long people were still getting into NES games. There wasn't as big of a push at that time to play like everything the day it comes out. You know, I mean, yes, they wanted you to go out and buy that stuff, but still you could kind of delve into the backlog a little bit more frequently than what you see today.
For sure. Yeah, there were no really pre-orders and hard release dates until, if you think about it, like Mortal Monday.
Yeah.
When Mortal Kombat came out, and then there was like whatever it was, Sonic 2 Tuesday or something like that.
Yeah, Sonic Tuesday.
Get it? All right, so... We're going to take a quick break. Lucky for you guys, you get to hear some awesome music from Castlevania one more time, or actually you get two more times. So stick around, and we'll be right back with our trip into the future and our revisiting of Castlevania on the Nintendo Entertainment System. So stick around. Awesome trip with your favorite doctor in the TARDIS. We are in 2013, and for the last week, we've been playing through Castlevania to the point of our Nintendo's freezing. Literally, my Nintendo froze while playing through Castlevania because I left it on all day, and I just kept going back, and I just would bang my head against that wall as much as I could, and once I couldn't take it anymore, I just turned the TV off, left the NES, you know, stay on, and go do something else and get my mind right before going back and jumping into the hell that is Castlevania all over again. But, you know, Trey, I'm going to start off with you. What format did you play this game on? Did you play it on your NES, or I think you might have mentioned you might have done a virtual console?
Yes, I did. I started out doing 3DS virtual console. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, I didn't pick that back up. I beat it twice. I beat it on Wii Virtual Console, and then I played the Game Boy Advance version. I found that laying around. I actually had a box of like Game Boy games and like older controllers and stuff.
Oh, cool.
And they released it. They had like a series of like
classics.
The NES classics, and I had it on there. So I said, okay, you know, I'll bust out the Game Boy Advance and try, you know, play through this. And so I beat it twice. I beat it once on I had the virtual console hooked up to the flat screen, which, you know, mixed opinions about that, but it was fun both times. I mean, you know, it was good having it on the go, but I mean, it was also fun playing it in the living room. So,
Trey, you brought up a great point of just how many times this game has shown up in certain places, and it's, you know, not only like the Game Boy Advance release, but obviously the Virtual Console releases, and also they did like a remake for it on the PlayStation 1 with Castlevania Chronicles.
Yeah,
as well, which is like, honestly, I don't like it. I think like the music stinks for it, but
does it?
And they just like they totally redid the music, almost like in a techno style. Like it sounds kind of bad. But
you know, say what you want about publishers and trying to, you know, really re-release games over and over to make a quick buck. It's really a testament to how good a quality the game is that, you know, they're re-releasing it on virtual console. I mean, they're giving people that didn't play it back then another chance to play it, and I think a game as good as Castlevania should be experienced by as many people as possible. So, you know,
how was it playing on the 3DS? Did it feel all right with the controls?
Yeah, I didn't have any issues with it. Cool. Yeah, I didn't have any issues that on that or the Game Boy Advance. Game Boy Advance feels more like an NES controller with its button layout being as simple as it is. But
did they do anything interesting with that release, or is it like basically a ROM dump with the emulator on it?
Well, I haven't played the NES version in so long.
Oh yeah,
I guess the virtual console version is a complete ROM of it, and I didn't notice many differences between that and the Game Boy Advance one. So
fair enough.
That I noticed. No, there wasn't much difference.
Yeah, I mean, for people out there, I just want to give everyone a taste, because who knows what people are going to play this on? Very few people are probably going to pull out, you know, their NES or go find an NES to play it on. And, you know, they don't really have to, because it's $5 and you can play it on 3DS, like you said, Trey, or on the Wii. And I think on the 3DS, the games like on the XL, I think NES games look great. I think some games just kind of play funny with the way the button layout is.
Right.
But, you know, it's definitely great to have options. How about you, Josh?
Yeah, I played it on the 3DS XL just for convenience sake. And I didn't like the way that it felt. I think I'm starting to realize that I just don't like the D-pad very much on the 3DS. On the 3DS or the 3DS XL, which was part of the reason I upgraded to the XL, was that I liked the D-pad a little bit more. And I still do like it more than the regular 3DS D-pad. But my wife always calls me a D-pad snob. And I think she's really speaking the truth in this case. I just don't feel like that D-pad feels very good for retro games. Perhaps it holds up a little bit better when you're playing something like New Super Mario Brothers 2. So I ended up playing it with the little thumbstick thing, with a little slider, I think is what they call it. Because I felt like I could control my jumps a little bit better. When I was playing with the D-pad, I would sometimes try to jump and move forward at the same time, and I would just jump straight up in the air. But I was using the slider, I would always jump forward.
How would you compare the slider to, like, say, an NES D-pad? Is there no comparison, or is, I mean, did I would you like the slider for it?
No, I would much rather play with a good D-pad. So yeah. That would be a much better experience just actually playing it on the original NES, which I did just a few years back. I much prefer that. Just because that D-pad is perfect. And, you know, it was designed for that controller. So right. It's designed to have the two buttons side by side, like what Kevin was talking about a minute ago, instead of the buttons in the more SNES style, you know, four button kind of cross layout.
Or even like just the ability to customize the button selection on the 3DS. Nintendo, that's so dumb that you can't do it. It makes no sense.
And the fact that they'll let you do these save states that you can reload over and over and over again, like on a PC game. The fact that they'll let you do that, which is changing the experience so much, what difference does it make if you change the button layout?
Yeah. All right.
You're right, because that does alter it big time.
Yeah. You know, it's a very different experience at that point. But yeah, it's still, I will say, it's really nice to be able to play a game like that on the go, to be able to just close the 3DS and open it back up an hour later and, you know, try again at that boss that keeps destroying you.
Otherwise, your NES freezes and you got to you know, right in the middle of your fight with Dracula, which was awesome. That was
so you,
cool.
You don't know anything about that, do you, Kevin?
No. Well, I you know, again, you guys know me, I love the authentic feel to this stuff, and it's going to come up later in the show of really why it matters. But the you know, the ability to get, you know, again, I got a great, it's for some reason people care about this, but I have the 5-screw version of Castlevania, like the original print run of Castlevania. I have one of those, and
nice.
The game just looks super good on a Sony Wega TV. If you guys are listening to this podcast and you're thinking about buying some of these old consoles, jump on Craigslist, find like a 24, 27, 32 inch Sony Wega TV with some S video input for the later systems. You know, do it for yourself, and you know, it might give you you know, a reason to lift some weights, because those things are like like my 32 is 200 pounds. So
hey, but they're fairly inexpensive on Craigslist.
They're free. They're not. They don't cost anything. People are giving them away, and they're fantastic televisions. They'll last for the next 15 years, 20 years.
Yeah, just bring your bodybuilding friend, like you said.
Yeah. And you know, the ability to play it on that has its positives and negatives. Like I said, I would kind of like play through a couple levels. I play for like 20 minutes, and then I would pause it. I'd go back to work. Like, I'd do some work from home. I'd go back to work, and I would try to come back to it fresh without being frustrated, because, again, with this game, I had to, you know, Kevin, you got to be patient. I can't be the Halo-playing dude who has a rechargeable shield and can just run into battle and not worry about anything. You can die super quick in this game, and even just regular enemies with 5 hits, they will kill you. There's pits that you can die in all over the place. But let's be real, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm just trying to say that in the format that I played it in, while it does feel great to have that nostalgic feeling, and that's kind of what this podcast is about for me, I think, you know, there are some drawbacks to it. And at the same time, you know, again, I think the bad thing with save states is that I was forced to play through stage 3 over and over and over and over again until I mastered it. Then I went to stage four and I had to play it over and over, like Journey to Silius last week. And I had to continue to play this level until I was like, all right, I know the skeleton's going to pop out there. I'm going to jump and I'm going to throw my whip and I'm going to hit the skeleton midair and I'm going to be good to go. All right, Medusa heads or whatever, those flying heads that kind of go like up and down, those things right now aren't even a problem for me. I'm not even fazed by those anymore because I know exactly how to avoid them and the pattern on how to attack them, when to, you know, press B to throw the whip. I have it all down. It's no problem anymore. Don't even worry about it. And then I really would just, like, right now I played through it this morning and I was able to get through the first I should say the third level. I meant like really stage 9 or whatever. Okay, so because obviously there's 18 stages, but there's really like six levels. There's six bosses, so I apologize if that's confusing. But anyways, like I said, it was just, you know, you master the game. You become a game master when it comes to this stuff.
And that's how they actually made these games long experiences. You know, like today, everybody's like, I want the game to be 15 to 20 hours. Eight hours is too short. But it was replaying levels and mastering them, which would make a game that's like about 3 hours, which is what I think Castlevania actually is, maybe two or something.
Oh, it's way short than that. I think it's like an hour. Like,
like if you know exactly what you're doing, you can just blow through it. But realistically, if you're just playing it on the original NES without save states or anything, you know, it's going to be a much longer experience, well over 10 hours by the time you learn all the levels and have to master them.
Well, I think the game is pretty kind of basic. It is an earlier NES game. I think the cool thing is the attention to detail in this game, and you know, I'll get the ball rolling. We might as well get it out of the way. Let's talk about the music real quick. And while the music is really good, I think the most fascinating and the most enjoyable part of this game for me is then right when you get to stage 7 after beating that, like, you know, squid Medusa thing head. Right after that point, Wicked Child kicks in, and when that kicks in, it is just a sign to you that, you guys, shit's about to go down. You know what? Those first 6 stages or 2 levels, that was just, you know, practice. That was just like the warm-up. Shit's about to get real. Good luck. And I think that is really cool. It's kind of like part of the whole angle that I want to go into with the attention to detail. But, you know, Trey, what kind of stood out to you?
The boss music.
Oh, yeah, no, it's good.
I heard it enough.
It's super frustrating. Or it's super, like, you know, it makes you kind of, like, panic. It really gets the tension going.
Yep, you hear that, and you're like, oh, well, I'm about to die. Let's see what I can learn. Now, that stood out to me. Yeah, like you said, stage 7, it really picks up. It really picks up the pace and kind of gives you that feel like, oh, yeah, levels 1 and 2, we're training. We're preparing you for the ass-kicking that's stage 7 through, you know, 18. So I think the boss music stood out to me the most. You know, just kind of that sense of dread, and, you know, you knew something was about to go down. Shit was about to get real.
You said it really well when you said, what am I about to learn?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, because, you know, it's trial and error. You give it a couple of tries, and, you know, you hear it so much. But, I mean, even after hearing that boss music as many times as I did, and I assure you it was a lot, it's still catchy to me. So,
yeah, that is a good sign for that music, I believe.
How about the perfect, the death, you know, the death sound was like, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and it's just like you dropping your shoulders. Like, it is just like you're kind of like just kind of falling over in, oh man, I just like just got blown back. And that's like one of the annoying things is that about this game is, when you get hit by enemies, you fall backwards. And if you're jumping midair, sometimes you don't fall backwards. You turn midair and then you fall forwards and then you fall into a pit, or get into, like, when you get to like stage 10 and there's lots of empty space below you where there's water and there's pits, and you just keep hearing that noise. And I'm going to probably mix it in here right now so you can hear that. But it's like, it is just, man, it just kind of just demotivates you a little bit.
It's a very traditional, like, video game death sound, like very 1980s you know, this is a sign that you messed up. And the game has a lot of sounds like that. Like when you pick up items, like you were talking about, the sort of reward sounds, and then some of the like just like blips and bloops kinds of sounds that were so prevalent in early NES games, which for something as atmospheric as Castlevania is somewhat surprising, I think, with how good the music is and how much they nail the atmosphere otherwise, that it's so video gamey in terms of sound effects.
The atmosphere is absolutely there, and I think, you know, not only from, like I said, it's kind of a basic graphically, it's a basic looking game, but there is attention to detail. The backgrounds aren't all the same. It's not just like a copy paste. There's changes in the brickwork. You know, there's changes in the backgrounds as you go through stages. It's not just the same thing over and over and over again to save space on the cart or to make it, you know, easier to load or whatever. So, yeah, I thought that's an important tone to set. And again, it shows the effort that was put into this game. Like when you walk upstairs, your foot always steps on a step. It's not like the PS1 or, you know, like even like the PS2 days where you would walk downstairs and you'd be just like walking kind of like in midair, or you'd just be walking in the middle. Like Shenmue was when we got to that point where we could walk upstairs and have your foot touch the step every single time. Like that was, you know, again, attention to detail that I kind of appreciated. And, you know, I think the animation in itself was just really good. And like Trey, you mentioned the boss battles, like those bosses, they were really cool looking, you know, they were hard, but they were just really cool to look at. And they were intimidating.
They were the Medusa head, scary shit.
Well,
if I got to that as a child, that would have terrified me.
Well, and it's like it's super intimidating until you figure out how to beat it. And then you're like blowing through the bosses in 2 seconds. Like I got stuck on like the first boss on Tuesday night or something like that when I was playing through it. I got stuck on the two mummies and I was like, I just could not figure out how to get past these guys. And then right before it, there were the two skeleton snakes. And then when I started figuring out how to beat those guys and then get to the boss with full health, it was, you know, relatively easy, and it just turned into like bending, you know, ducking and spamming the whip, and then it was no problem. And then same thing, like kind of going forward, the bosses were relatively easy once you figured out your plan of attack, but, you know, sometimes that might take you 4 or 5 continues, and the cool thing about that is that you get unlimited continues, so at least they're nice to you that way.
They're fair in that way. Hey, I wanted to say something about the two mummy boss fight since you just brought that up. That's a case of finding the hidden meat that refills your health. That's a real game changer in that fight specifically. Because it's like in the bottom left corner, if you hit one of the blocks, it breaks and you get a big, what is that, ham or maybe it's a nice pot roast. I'm not sure what that is. But you get that in that mummy boss fight, and then all of a sudden you're rejuvenated after having faced those snake skeletons and everything. So that's a really finding those hidden meat and pieces of hidden meat and knowing where they were, that could be a real game changer. So that's like the kind of thing where it's kind of like Metroid, you know, I'd run around jumping and hitting every block I could see. You know, is there some health in here? Because the candles stand out where you get your item power up ability, but the meat, not so much.
Absolutely, and I think that was what you needed to do to survive. You had to learn where everything was, whether it be through, you know, your favorite game magazine and or just, you know, spamming the whip and trying every single block. And that's what I did. You know, like you, Josh, I just would every time I was like, man, there might be, because you could kind of tell like in the corners or at an edge where you could see you could still make a jump from there. You would be like, man, there's probably something hidden under here. And I didn't even know like what the Roman numeral 2s and 3s were until literally yesterday. I didn't know what that effect was. I just thought it was like a special power or something like that. And then I finally realized that when I was going after, I forget which boss it was. I think it was the Medusa head, when I was able to like just throw a ton of holy waters down and make the head get stuck where I didn't take any damage and it never fired anything at me. That's when I realized, oh man, it means I can just throw more of my special items out at once. And I wish I knew that beforehand, because it this is an NES game where you really don't get things explained to you. There is no tutorial. There's an instruction book, but those are kind of hard to come by these days. And I'm like, with this whole project, with this whole podcasting thing, my whole like rule set is I don't go to the internet. I don't look at guides. I don't look at videos. I make myself either have to look into a Nintendo Power or, you know, whatever, like an EGM or something like that. Otherwise, I have to figure it out on myself because I want to kind of make myself go back to that time and place where we had to play it like that.
That's a really cool way to do it. And I'm doing the same thing. I won't watch anything on it until I've beaten the game. Then I'll do a lot of reading and watching some YouTube videos to see people who do like speed runs and things like that. That can be really neat to see after the fact.
Yeah, but let's play the videos. Those are pretty entertaining for some of the games. At least I've watched a couple of those.
Yeah, have you ever recorded one of those, Trey?
I have not. I just got the software to where I could potentially do them now. Just finding the time.
Yeah.
The only thing, but I wouldn't mind doing that. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah, I agree. A little off topic, I know, but
yeah.
But you know, I kind of see Let's Play videos as it's like going over to a friend's house today. You know, to see these people who are really good sometimes at the video game, do like a speed run or something like that. And there's some amazing Castlevania 1 players. So I encourage you guys to look some of that up on YouTube. Like perfect runs through like really difficult bosses and through the whole game. Really neat to see.
Cool deal.
Yeah, the last thing I wanted to quickly mention were the glitches in the game. This is not a glitch-free game, and one of the cool ones that comes to your advantage is when you get hit, like if you get hit by a projectile and then you throw your whip at the same time, like the snake skeletons that will throw fireballs at you, if you get hit with a fireball and then hit them with your whip at the same exact time, it will instantly die, which was, you know, nice sometimes when you're just getting frustrated and spamming the hell out of the whip. And also, again, taking advantage of the limitations of the game. And, you know, if it's going to be super difficult, take every advantage you can. Like if an enemy goes into the side of the screen, it doesn't come back. And you can kind of get, you can kind of like kill it off screen or whatever. So I thought that was something that you are perfectly allowed to take advantage of. Especially when like you get to things like stage 10 and it is that water level where there's just crap coming at you from the side with bats, from under the water with the fish heads. They're just, things are coming all over the place. And that is just one place where you will get stuck. Like you won't even get past that first stage in that level because you're just constantly dying and dying and dying. So,
yeah, and that level also, it can be hard sometimes to see, like, there'll be things in the background that look kind of like platforms. I don't know if you guys
experienced
that. Yeah,
on the bottom,
yeah,
like the skulls, the skull and bones that are, no, I totally did that, and I even did it in the later gameplay, in the later playthroughs, too.
Yeah, so you'll jump and
nothing.
Fall into nothing and then lose a life and be brought back a lot farther back than you wanted to be.
Yeah, so final words that the game is beautifully basic and it is a great like entry to the series because I think it was really important to start with this one because they do iterate so well in the later games, maybe not counting Simon's Quest where they try to do something a little bit weird, but maybe we will hit on that game at some point, talk about Simon's Quest, and hopefully in today, like with our knowledge, we could have a better time with it.
Trey loves it, I know.
Yeah, I don't know about all that.
Simon's Quest?
The only thing I've ever seen for Simon's Quest was the Angry Video Game Nerd, and that was enough to make me not want to play it.
Nintendo Power promoted that game really well. Speaking of, you know, we're always referring to music at Nintendo
Power. There's a full guide of it that Nintendo Power did. They did a fantastic job, you know, because obviously they knew that if you're screwed, if you can't get through this, if you don't have a guide, you're not going to get through this part. So I think Simon's Quest is something that I own now. I bought it last week on like I've said, I spent tons of money on eBay in the news section, and I got that in last week, and I started playing through it. I was kind of enjoying it. I was really starting to dig it, so I might have to put pressure on you guys at some point, maybe a couple months to play through that and see what happens. But Any final words, Trey, before we move on to our mini boss for this week?
Well, it you know, this was a challenging game, and it was a good feeling to go back and beat it, you know, and go through and play through it twice. And it took me a couple hours the first time because it had been so long since I played it. But, you know, a lot of games back then, they just feel more rewarding when you beat them. A lot of stuff now is just kind of for show and to create like spectacle and everything. Whereas games like this, you know, you sit down, you learn them, you master them, and you feel really accomplished when you beat it. And I get that sense from Castlevania. I just felt like really like I was happy. I was proud of myself that, you know, I was able to go through and beat it. And that made me want to go through and play it again. And, you know, I just found a different means of different system to play it on. But it was, you know, it was a good week for retro gaming for me. It was a lot of fun, and you know, look forward to more experiences like that. Not to say the ones we haven't played before that weren't, you know, didn't have a good payoff or anything, but this game was, it stuck out as pretty challenging, and it's something I remember playing as a kid. So to go back and have a good time with it was just a good experience.
Did you beat it as a kid?
I did not.
Okay, so this was your first time beating it.
I was a teenager when I first beat it. I think my buddy had like an NES, and we had like a Mega Man Castlevania like game night, and we played a bunch of Mega Man games and played that, and I beat it. So it wasn't the first time I'd beaten it, but it had been a good, I'd say, 10 years since I played it. So
okay, yeah. So it is rewarding once you finally experience
very much
that,
so, very joy. Much so. Yep.
Or very if the much. Game had been banned from your house, like Kevin.
Yeah.
What? Final words. Real talk. I played this on an NES. I didn't have save states. That's what's up. I have Streets of Rage 2. I think we should go talk about that.
I want to say one more thing about Castlevania, and then I'm getting pretty pumped for Streets of Rage 2. Okay, the Grim Reaper fight, guys, in level 15. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but there were like scythes flying around throughout the whole fight. I think that's what it was. Or maybe they were fireballs of some sort. And it felt kind of like playing like a shmup where you're like dodging bullets constantly, dodging those things. And here's my story about that. So I died a lot in that fight, and I kept doing it over and over and over again. And one of the times I finally defeated the Grim Reaper, and I was really excited about it. And I even let out, you know, a big cheer lying in bed, which was weird. But, you know, I was very excited that I finally had done that. And then there was still one of these flying objects floating around the room. And so the Grim Reaper's dead, but these are still floating around. It hit me. I died, and I still had to start over.
No.
So even after defeating him. So you have to, like, go and touch that little orb thing that you get after defeating a boss.
Oh, no.
So that is the NES. That's playing Castlevania 1 on the NES in a nutshell. Stuff like that happening. And I love it. I love it. I miss things like that, you know, that you have to stay focused. You know, that's like you can't do a celebration
until
you cross
the goal line.
Yeah, you know, like you have to.
Same thing in Journey to Silius. The same thing happened where if you still beat the boss, but there were projectiles coming at you and you died, tough shit, man.
Yep, you get what you earn, and I certainly did in that case.
This is the NES, man. You don't become invincible once you beat the boss. You got to survive all the projectiles.
Yep. I relearned that lesson the hard way.
And do yourself a favor, if you're going to play this game, once you pick up the orb and you beat the boss, hold down A and B so you start jumping and whipping your whip so you can get it frozen in midair. It is the coolest thing that you'll experience in the game, I promise you. Stick around, we'll be right back with Streets of Rage 2. All right, we're here for the mini boss for this week, and we're going to be talking about Streets of Rage 2 for the Sega Genesis. And your first question is, why aren't you talking about Streets of Rage 1? And the simple answer is, and I will defend this to anyone, but I think Streets of Rage 2 is really the iteration, what should have been Streets of Rage 1. I think they fixed so many things from Streets of Rage 1 in Streets of Rage 2. So, and it's kind of like the same game, like any iteration of a beat 'em up, like the Final Fight 1, 2, and 3, where you talk about your Streets of Rage or your Golden Axe 1, 2, and 3. Like all that stuff, I think I can defend that, and I will defend that. If you disagree with me, go into the thread and yell at me. So the history breakdown, quick history breakdown for Streets of Rage came out in North America, or we should start in Japan. Or no, we should start in North America because it came out in North America first on December 20th, 1992. Right before Christmas.
What a weird release date. That never happens now.
They got it out, man. As long as they got it out. I'm sure sure some, you know, kid was waiting for it. And then in Japan on January 14th, 1993, so not that far off. And just to give you a heads up, in Japan it was actually called Bare Knuckle is the franchise, and it was Bare Knuckle 2. You might notice as a fun fact in the game, the arcade machines are labeled Bare Knuckle on the arcade machines. They're all Bare Knuckle machines. So in case you didn't know. And, you know, I think the important thing that we're going to be talking about again, you know, is a running trend, but the composer is Yuzo Koshiro. And the soundtrack for the Streets of Rage franchise is really iconic on the Sega Genesis because it didn't sound like a lot of the Genesis games, kind of like how Sonic the Hedgehog didn't sound like lazy music on the Sega Genesis, which I think it was John Riccardi on the A4 podcast that said it sounded like a series of farts is what the Sega sound chip of the Genesis sound chip sounds like. And for a lot of games, it does because people were really lazy with how they implemented that in the game. Some other real quick history and fun facts is that the 8-bit versions of the game on the Sega Master System and the Sega Game Gear are like completely different games. So if you picked up that copy, we're not going to be talking about that. And they even made an arcade version of Streets of Rage 2, which was released onto Sega's Mega Drive-based Mega Play hardware in the arcades in Japan. And it used a regular credit system, and also in this version, or in that version, all the one-ups were replaced by money bags. So there's no in-game timer, and the difficulty levels are also increased by one. So it's on hard automatically from the Mega Drive version / Genesis version. And, you know, it's kind of a really interesting franchise. And I think what we should do is we're not going to kind of, you know what? Let's take a break. We're going to take a break, because there is some really good music that you're going to want to listen to. It's going to be a super long podcast, but stick around. We'll be back with the return to our history with the game. Okay, we're back, fueling up that time machine again this week and going back to 1992. I guess it's right before Christmas, but for most of us, it's going to be after that. And, you know, I'd love to start off with my quick story of Streets of Rage 2, because I think I mentioned it before, but my introduction to the Sega Genesis was at a friend's house down the street in 1991. They got that Altered Beast, you know, package that it launched with. But I never got one myself until like 1994 with Sonic the Hedgehog 2. And it was a beautiful time because I was able to go to my local Funko Land and I picked up Streets of Rage 1. I brought that home and I beat it in like a week. And then I went back and I traded that in with Mortal Kombat 2 and picked up Streets of Rage 2. And like I said, it was just like a complete level above what Streets of Rage 1 brought, where they, you know, started doing like the weird weird things in beat 'em ups, like giving all the enemies names, like giving them specific names sometimes, even though they were the, you know, basically duplicates of each other, and there would be like slight variations in the game. But I'm gonna throw this out there before you know, sending it off to you, Josh. But I played at the time. I had played Final Fight. I had played Streets of Rage 1 and Streets of Rage 2, and I think Streets of Rage is way more fun. It's a way more fun franchise, even though it doesn't look as nice. I really got more enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, I think that Streets of Rage perhaps has a little bit more atmosphere. You know, like it's just a weird world, and it has like more iconic characters than Final Fight. But I'm a Final Fight guy, and maybe it's the Nintendo fanboy in me, but I know it's Capcom joint, but still, it's, you know, Streets of Rage was never on SNES, so Streets of Rage just can't quite add up to my Final Fight love.
Do you tell me that story of Mr. X?
Which, does that mean Mr. Extreme?
Mr. X, come on, this is a very heartfelt, anyone can relate to this story. Mr. X abducts Adam, who's in the first game. So his little bro, Skate, that's his nickname, Skate, goes to our heroes, Axel and Blaze, the other two that I guess haven't been kidnapped. It says, yo, guys, I need your help. I'm on rollerblades. Let's go kick some ass. And I think that can – it's basically like the Goodwill Hunting of video game stories. Trey, when did you get involved with this game?
About 6 days ago.
Oh, so you just played it for the first time?
Very first time.
Awesome.
And I need you to do some educating for me here. I'm going to play the uneducated person here because I have a couple questions based on what I did play. Streets of Rage, and I played Final Fight back when I had a Super NES, so I am familiar with Final Fight.
Mm-hmm.
Did the same people that worked on those two games collaborate at all? Because they play almost identically to me.
That's just what it was. When you looked at any of those games, like even like Sonic Blast Man, or you look at the later Double Dragon games, they just
health bars, like the food they got to heal, like the weapon, like it just it, like I honestly thought that the same people worked on those two games. They were that similar.
It was like the basketball game. It was like the football game. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, different companies, but it was more or less the same rules.
Yeah, and that's the vibe I got. I like Final Fight because this is going to sound really corny, but the one of the guys you fight in there looked like Andre the Giant. I was a big Andre the Giant fan. So I don't know.
It was like Andre, right?
Yeah, I think that was his name. It was like I think it was two set of twins that you fight in a wrestling ring, I think.
But the names, like in Streets of Rage 1, they didn't have names for the enemies. They just, like a name didn't pop up, but that came in Streets of Rage 2. So I'm sure they looked at Final Fight and said, hey, you know, we got to name our guys like Z and BJ.
And Donovan.
And Billy.
Tons of Donovan. So many Donovans. And, like, the cool thing, like, it was stupid, but they would, for like, themed characters, like, bosses, like, there was the mini-boss that had, like, a jetpack. So his name was Jet. And then you see him later in the game, and his name is Mach. Like, Mach 2, if you were in a jet. So really, really great inventive stuff there. But I even think, like, what the hell was the point of giving them names? Who gives a crap? Who is even looking? Like, I'm looking at their health bar to see how much I've beaten the crap out of them.
Yeah, exactly. You just want to beat their ass.
Yeah, so I think another thing that's really cool about Streets of Rage 2 is it literally starts in the same stage as Streets of Rage 1, or at least it looks like it. Like, it's the same exact area, but it just looks better. And it's like, man, I get kind of, like, I dig that. Like, I like Back to the Future 2 and 3, where they're revisiting areas from Back to the Future 1. Like, that's super cool to do, like, at in a different angle or a different perspective, or in this case, better graphics. And I think the game in itself is just – it just exuberates fun because you can grapple a dude. Then you can jump over him. Then you can – come on, Trey. You got to appreciate this. You can suplex the guy, or you can throw him behind you. Like, that is awesome. Like, it is just – so much fun to beat up dudes that even I was trying to connect with my buddy, and I should have mentioned this. Well, we haven't revisited it yet. Oh, wait. I guess let's make this one big segment, all right? We're breaking the rules. But, you know, but finishing off with my history of the game, like, when I saw it, it was on the back of the box. It was on the Sega Genesis box when I bought it. So I kind of, like, needed this game. And that is what kind of drew me to it. So I apologize. It was kind of out of order, but needed to mention that. And that's like that whole grapple flipping over, like, and throwing, like, that was the same kind of joy you got when you played stuff like Turtles in Time, when you would grab a dude and throw him towards the screen.
At the screen.
Yeah. Yep. It was like the same kind of, man, this is just, I'm just a bad dude, and not bad dudes, but just a bad dude, because bad dudes really isn't that good on the NES. So don't play it. Try to get the arcade game if you can.
So who was your favorite character? Both of you guys, I'm asking this question.
Blaze. Got to do Blaze.
I played as Axel.
Blaze and Axel. Okay. So what attracted you to Blaze?
Because I used to always play as Axel.
Ah, so
I would always be the generic white dude. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you didn't have a female character. You're walking around beating everybody up that often back then, so that was different.
And I think Blaze just looks cool with her combos and stuff like that. And the problem is, like, with this game, you have the ability to do that, like, semi-special moves where you can – almost like a Street Fighter mechanic where you do, like, down, forward, punch. And, like, Axel would do his, like, you can't even understand what his digitized voice is saying, but, like, he would almost do an uppercut punch. And same thing. I mean, it was a lot harder. I could never get it down correctly with what's-her-face?
Blaze?
With Blaze. But I still had a lot of fun fighting with her.
Why Axel, Trey?
Honestly, gonna sound kind of underwhelming, but I just said I'm gonna play this dude. I didn't know anything about the characters, you know. I the first time I'd ever played Streets of Rage, I was just like, yep, just gonna beat some ass with this guy named Axel.
Well,
there was nothing that drew me to him. It was just random selection.
So Axel is sort of a good character, like, if you've never played the series before, just to start out, right? So you can kind of get, like, it's like playing the game on normal. You get the sort of generic experience of playing the game.
Middle of the road guy, yeah.
Right, yeah, middle of the road. It's like playing as Mario in Mario Kart, or Mario on Super Mario Brothers 2 or whatever. You know, you just kind of want to get a feel for what the game plays like. And then you can branch out into Blaze and... what was the dude on Skate's name again? Oh, come on. Give me that joke. Give me that joke, guys. Thank you.
Oh, no. Okay. You were tossing it up. All right. No. Yeah. Well, anyways, you know what? I can really appreciate a game, a beat 'em up, that gives me a really good jump kick. I need a good jump kick. You know, like Double Dragon for NES, that's a really bad jump kick. Like, that jump kick sucks. Like, this jump kick, and the big thing with... going back to Streets of Rage 2, it's all, for me, it was all about what I'm going to term as enemy stacking, all right? So, like, you kind of, like, need to move around the screen so you can stack up the enemies when you know, especially when you start getting 3, 4, 5 guys coming at you at once on the screen with different abilities and different, you know, AI attacks. Mm-hmm. So, I would have to kind of like stack them up so I could start punching them or jump kicking them to punch them all at once, because that's the great thing about beat 'em ups. If you get like four guys really close to each other, you can start a combo and it will affect all of them. So I, you know, again, learning how to play the game, learning how to take advantage of the systems that they're providing you with. And it, you know, again, it is just a, like, it's really fun. Like, it's not a boring beat 'em up like some of the other games out there, and it's not super difficult like Battletoads. It is just kind of like right in the middle of the road where you can, you know, have a just have fun with a buddy playing two players. Dude, let's play some Streets of Rage. And you can even grab each other and like do kind of weird stuff. Like if your buddy is playing as, you know, Blaze and you're Axel, and then you grab her from behind and then you make, you know, inappropriate jokes.
And this sounds like you're speaking from experience, Kevin.
Dude, you got it. Yeah. Okay. Again, I love this game. This might be like one of my top three favorite Genesis games, just because, and it's my favorite beat 'em up. Like I think it beats the crap out of Battletoads. I think it's better than Final Fight. And I think you guys are nuts for liking Final Fight. I think that is the most vanilla ass beat 'em up out there. And I think Sega just destroys everything else. And like the game is so weird. Like in the third stage, you're fighting like an alien head thing, like in a swamp. Like how did you get to a friggin' swamp? Like they just don't give a crap. It is the kind of dumb that I really like to see in a game, where you're just like, who cares? It's fun. I'm putting it into the game. Like all the different areas you go to, like you're fighting on a pirate ship, you're fighting in the sewers, you're fighting on a beach, you're fighting, like there's a fighting at a place where it looks like you're at Epcot or you're at Disney World, because you can see the Magic Kingdom in the background.
I think if Saints Row were a 2D beat 'em up, it would be Streets of Rage 2.
I hope it is. I hope Saints Row 4 is just secretly Streets of Rage. What would it be? I guess it wouldn't be 4, because they did Streets of Rage. They did so many bad Streets of Rage games.
Yeah, sure did. But yeah, you're right, though, about just the strange environments and strange enemies. I do love that.
And think about like what you got out of this game in terms of value. Like in the options menu or in the like selections, you get dual mode. So you get a Mortal Kombat, but I looked at it as a kid, like, oh man, I don't have Street Fighter, but we can play dual mode, which is like a one-on-one mode in Streets of Rage 2. That's just as good, right? Right? You know, there's no
you don't have to memorize a bunch of moves.
Totally. You can just beat the crap out of each other. But it was like those options that it gave you. And Double Dragon kind of did the same thing too. And I think, man, I think the Genesis is just chock full of great beat 'em ups. Like even Alien Storm, another great one that you can and I should say I played an emulated version of this game on the Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection. And it's like, it felt okay, but I felt so dirty doing, like playing it on my PlayStation 3. And I haven't been able to find a reasonably priced Sega Genesis yet, because the people on NeoGAF and the Genesis Forum have informed me that I need a Model 1 that says high definition graphics on it, because it has the best audio chip or sound chip in it. And I guess they kind of mess with the sound chip in the Model 2. So I'm still on the lookout for one of those, and obviously a Sega CD, so I can play my sealed copy of Night Trap, the Japanese version of Night Trap. I have the Sega CD version, and I believe it's region free, so I cannot wait to pop that in to a Sega CD.
Oh, glorious, glorious.
You guys ever play Beats? You guys hear of Beats of Rage?
No.
Okay. So Beats of Rage is a, like, it was a project that allowed you to create your own like Streets of Rage clone, but with different characters. And I played a bunch of these on the Sega Dreamcast. Like, they're free downloadable games, and I believe you can obviously play them on the PC as well. But they had like themed versions. Like, they had a Resident Evil version that was super cool, and they basically just dropped, like, they redrew all the sprites for this, and you can play like against zombies like in the Resident Evil version. It is super interesting, and if you like beat 'em ups and you want like a fresh take on them, look up Beats of Rage on the internet. It is just fantastic, and if you have a Dreamcast, you can download the games, burn them to a CD, and play them on your Dreamcast, and they look fantastic on your VGA output, or if you want to hook it up to a tube TV, they'll look outstanding. So I know there's not a lot out there, except like recently Double Dragon Neon, which I think is fantastic, but I think that is definitely one avenue that you should check out. Look him up, Beats of Rage on Google or your favorite.
It sounds awesome.
It's so cool because they did so many different franchises for Beats of Rage. And like being a freeware project, the community behind it is fantastic. Like they did a King of Fighters with King of Fighters characters. They did like I'm just kind of going down the list. There's so many different downloadable versions, and it's just like an engine that people can make stuff for, and like playing through basically Streets of Rage with King of Fighters enemies is so cool.
Yeah, well, that's the way it should be. We should be able to do that. Any Nintendo mods, or has Nintendo put the kibosh on that?
What do you mean? So you can play it on like a Nintendo
system? No, like with Nintendo characters in there.
Well, yeah, I don't. I mean, this is not licensed. This is just people doing like projects on it. I mean, I don't think they've shut any of them down, and I don't know if this would necessarily be considered like a, you know, like a pirated game. But
well, I mean, as long as it's not for profit, I think it's cool, right?
I guess so. I check them out.
We'll say that.
Look for Beats of Rage. There's a bunch of fantastic mods out there for it, and like there's an Aliens versus Predator one too. It's just so many cool things. Just unlimited beat 'em ups.
Well, I want to tell you guys about something related to Streets of Rage 2 that's not so cool, since you told us about something cool, and that's the iOS version of Streets of Rage 2. I downloaded it out of curiosity this week since we were playing this game, and it is very hard to play on the iPhone. First of all, it puts... Okay, so you guys are familiar with the touchscreen controls when they do the virtual D-pad and buttons? Like, generally, the D-pad will be in the bottom left of your iPhone screen.
It's terrible.
And oh, I know, it's so bad. And then the... It's not responsive at all. You can't tell, you know, sometimes if you're moving to the left or right. And then you'll have generally an A and a B button on the right bottom corner. This, though, since the Sega Genesis controller had three buttons, A, B, and C, it adds the C button, but not in a convenient way where you have A, B, and C side by side, all in a horizontal row. So you have A and B on a horizontal row in the bottom right-hand corner, and then you have the C button above the B button, directly above it. So imagine that. I could never even do a jump kick playing it on the iOS version. It was so hard to hit the buttons in the right order. So it's 99 cents. If you want to have a weird time, maybe you should download it. Otherwise, play the Genesis version.
And I think the Sega's or Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, I think that version is pretty good. People always complain that the sound, it doesn't sound right. But from my memory, it sounds pretty good. The ability to turn off smoothing is really nice, so you can get your nice fat pixels on there. And it, you know, you can do the save state thing if you want to. I didn't do that because, you know, again, I'm trying to keep it real, yo. And I think it's great because the Sega's, our Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection is $15 on eBay or on Amazon, and it comes with 30 awesome Sega games. So if you can't, you know, hook up a tube TV and you just want to play some Sega games, it has like all the Golden Axes, all the Sonic games, all the Echo games, all the Streets of Rage games. It's a really nice way to play it, and there's like a history tab for all the games, so you can look at the box art, you can look at the cart, and you can get some background on the game and some cool trivia about it. That's where I got some of the trivia for the podcast.
Oh, facts. Neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anything else, guys, before we take a quick break and then we go into the news segment?
Nope, not for me.
I miss beat 'em ups.
This is my best Axel impression.
Very nice. Back
with the news. Stick around. I thought that was accurate. We'll be right back. Okay, we're here for our news and other topics this week for the podcast. And, you know, unfortunately, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably heard the news of Ryan Davis of Giant Bomb passing last week at age 34. We lost him last Wednesday. And, you know, I've been talking with the guys on the show during the week. And, you know, this was really surprising as someone that you didn't really know, but I met him once at PAX East. I got to meet him maybe 3 years ago. It was when it was Mortal Kombat was first being shown at PAX, and I was in line with my buddy to see Mortal Kombat, and they were kind of skipping the line. They were doing their press thing, and I got to meet the guys and talk to them about Mortal Kombat for a little bit. And you know, again, it's really weird because like podcasting, like listening to right now, I listened to the Giant Bombcast since it was Arrow Pointing Down, and I'm sure you guys have been, you know, following the Giant Bomb website. I mean, they got hours of video that they're posting every week, and I find myself like watching every Thursday Night Throwdown and watching every Friday Unprofessional live stream, watching almost every Quick Look, to the point where I would almost not buy games because I could just watch their Quick Looks and get a lot out of it. And you get so much out of these guys' personalities once you hear, you know, hundreds, if not over 1,000 hours of their voice and seeing their face in these videos. And then to find out, you know, tragically, 5 days after his wedding, he passed away in his sleep. And it's just nothing short of a unbelievably, horrifically terrible thing. And, you know, it's been interesting to see how it has affected, hearing the news and seeing the reactions from the staff and the spotlight that they're kind of in, being that they are almost like internet celebrity type people. But
they really are, yeah.
Yeah. And it was such a tragic, tragic story. I've never cried for someone that I've not known that has died before. And even sometimes people that I've known, I have not cried for when they've died, but it was a monumental loss. And the only thing I could think of is, you know, I'm never going to hear him host a show again, or never hear him on the Giant Bombcast again, or I'm never going to, see him again at PAX and stuff like that. So it was just really terrible. And, Josh and Trey, Josh, you were talking about it earlier off the air, how much it's just a shock.
Yeah, it most certainly is. And 34 years old, I believe.
Yeah.
So someone from the same generation as us, pretty close in age to us. And so you just kind of, you don't really think about life slipping away at that sort of age. But talking about the reaction to his passing shows just how much this man was loved, not only by his friends and family, obviously, and obviously our thoughts and prayers and condolences go out to them because it's an unbelievable loss that they've experienced. But to the video game community at large, that all these people who maybe only met him briefly at a trade show, or maybe never met him at all, but just listened to the podcast every week, they felt like they had a relationship with him, right? And that's sort of the interesting thing about this phenomenon of podcasting, is that you can spend a few hours a week with people that you don't even know and feel like you really get to know them. You hear about their lives and different things that they have going on, and so you form that bond. And he just always exuded such charisma and happiness, and talk about living your life the right way. He had a really good time. Nobody could say that Ryan Davis didn't enjoy his life while he was here and that he didn't make the most of it.
Trey, did you have anything you wanted to jump in on? Or
Josh said a lot of, what I was thinking, because, I listened to the Bombcast, not as long as everybody else. I really didn't follow Giant Bomb until about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I like what they've done with the site. I like, the site is run as just a couple guys that just are passionate about video games. They don't let corporate sponsoring or anything like that affect how they do things. It's a community for gamers. And the Bombcast was something I kind of, you know, just started listening to casually, and just hearing the guys come together, it was just like a group of friends that could sit there and, you know, they might not necessarily talk about games the entire podcast. They talk about, you know, recently it was Vinny's kid, or, you know, random stuff that Patrick did, or, you know, it was like, it was just, you know, it was a bunch of random wrapped up around video game discussion. And it was just so down to earth and so casual. And, you know, I just got used to it every Tuesday waiting for that podcast to come out so I could download it and listen to it throughout the week. And, you know, it really breaks my heart what happened to him. And it's really sad. And, you know, if I could say anything positive about, you know, the whole situation, it's how the video game industry has seemed to kind of come together. You know, nobody said a bad word about Ryan Davis. IGN, GameSpot, Game Trailers, all the other main sites like that, you know, have posted something, you know, expressing their, you know, sorrow about it and saying a couple words about him. I mean, I've read a couple blogs that people have written that, you know, were really, really, really touching. And it's just, you know, it's good to see everybody kind of come together to, you know, mourn the loss of somebody that's part of the industry like he is and that had a big impact on the industry like he does. So, you know, it's Tuesdays are not going to be the same anymore, unfortunately.
Every day is not going to be the same anymore. I mean, they post stuff every day.
Right,
I know you mean
right.
The podcast.
But. Yeah, I mean the podcast, you know, because the podcast is really the thing that I listen to or, you know, interact with the most with Giant mm-hmm. Bomb.
And he was the host, of course.
And he was the host, well. Yeah. And he was a damn good host, too. Mm-hmm. You know, so I agree. Not every day is going to be the same. But for me, the, you know, Tuesday, the Bombcast came out, and that was the day I would put aside everything just to sit there and listen to them for, you know, 2-3 hours, however long they recorded that week. So it's sad and, you know, shocking, very shocking.
Hey, but if you listen to their latest Bombcast, they already are having really great conversations. They spent a long time just talking about Ryan Davis, telling a lot of funny stories.
It's pretty touching. Yes,
yeah,
too.
It's a fitting way to remember him.
It was, yep. It's very good. And, you know, kudos to those guys for being able to do that, because, you know, I don't know if I was in a situation like them, if I could get on there and do that without, you know, because, I mean, Jeff and Ryan were pretty much inseparable. They were best friends. You know, I think weren't they not co-founders for Giant Bomb?
Yeah,
I think they co-founded. I mean, that's got to be, you know, I can't even imagine what he's been going through. And
well, it's like when you get to that point where you almost feel selfish because you think like, you know, I'm thinking like, man, what does this mean for the website? What does it mean for everything? Like the web, what is the website if, you know, he's not there, and, you know, what is, you know, Jeff's mindset going to be? But, you know, again, I think they have every right to do whatever the heck they want. This is a devastating loss, and I could never even imagine if I lost, like, you know, my best friend who I've been, you know, I was his best man at his wedding. You know, I don't know what I would do. You know, it's just a impossible situation to build a scenario around. It's nothing like you said, he's going to be incredibly missed, and mm-hmm. he's I've been going back through, like, I spent a lot of the week watching his old videos. I've been all weekend, I started at episode 1 of Arrow Pointing Down and going through all the old Bombcasts to kind of pass the time while walking my dog or doing stuff around the house. And, you know, you got to remember he's going to be remembered in that way. He's going to be remembered through the podcast and through the videos, and his, you know, legacy is always going to be on that website. It's always going to be in the industry, and it's going to be in all the media that he's been a part of.
Well said.
Yep.
All right. So, in letter news, I went to the flea market this morning at 4:15, and how do you transition from that?
I know it's tough.
And, well, anyways, we're going to do our best. So, you know, obviously, you know, we're going to do our best. So with the, I think this is relevant. I went to the flea market this morning at 4:15, set the alarm with the Zelda 2 theme playing, or the opening title screen for Zelda 2. That's a great alarm clock, by the way. If you guys ever want to use that, feel free. And
the title screen?
Yep.
Okay, so
it just builds up nice. It's nice and soothing to wake up to. So the hit up the flea market, which I haven't done in like a couple of years. I used to be hardcore, going to the flea market every weekend, going to every yard sale, like built up a huge collection of games. And then I stopped doing that because I got a job. And the I just started doing it again yesterday or today. And because of the podcast kind of motivated me to do that. And I saw some really cool stuff. First off, if you're going to go to flea markets, don't go at 8 a.m. If they open, like this one opens at 5, I was there at 5 a.m. for it to open because there's lots of competition for video game stuff out there. There, trust me, at yard sales, there's going to be people asking for video games because they sell for a high price on eBay now. And it's just worth considering. So I saw some cool stuff there. First off, I saw like two Commodore VIC-20s, which I've never seen before in person, but I saw two of them today, Josh, Mike. And the amazing thing was like it has a tape drive, like a cassette tape drive that you would hook up to it. And this guy had a like a box full of like custom-made programs on tape that someone wrote. And then I guess recorded to the tape. I just thought it was super interesting. But most of the time, you're going to find overpriced stuff with eBay prices on there. But I was so lucky at one of the places where I saw the Commodore VIC-20, I started like talking to the guy about like, yeah, Commodore 64 stuff. And then his brother pulled out of the car a, you know, like the top of a box of paper. He pulled out a box top full of Super Nintendo games, 22 to be exact. And then my eyes kind of opened up real wide, and I said, hey, how much for each Super Nintendo game? Because I started seeing titles like Turtles in Time, Super Mario RPG, Mario Allosaurus, Mario Kart, Castlevania 4.
Wow.
Like, the hard hitters were all a part of this, you know, aside from your Bubsy 1s and Bubsy 2s, Donkey Kong Country 1 and 2. Like, it was an expensive lot, let's put it that way. And wow. He goes, well, look, it's 20, so let's do $40. And I say, you know, it's what if I just, how about 30? He says, all right, no, 35, you know, halfway. And I said, oh, well, how about, let me just pick a couple out of here then. He says, all right, just if you want to take them all of them for $30, take them for $30. Boom, got 20 cards for $30. And the big ones that I wanted were, like the Mario RPG, which does have its saves working, which is great. And, you know, I got a really nice looking Castlevania 4, which replaces the Made in Mexico version that I had, which is if you want to ever get into that, the different production runs of Super Nintendo games, we can get into that. But it was just really cool, and I didn't see really anything else except overpriced stuff. And I unfortunately didn't see, the only Sega stuff I saw was a copy of Jeopardy for $2 in box, and Genesis controllers for $6 that looked like a cat pissed on them, so I did not buy those. And I just really recommend, if you guys want to get into this stuff, like hit up flea markets, but go super early. And looks like we have to do a Mario RPG episode at this point, at some point, right before the Super Paper Mario episode. You can mix that in there, Trey.
I'm very excited to play Mario RPG. I've never finished it. I've only rented it a couple of times as a kid, so this is good news.
Yeah, I'm pumped, man. That was one of the – I've had some really great finds in those, like, that year and a half that I was hardcore about this, but that was, you know, the only thing I really found to buy that day. And also, I passed on an inbox Commodore – no, Magnavox – no, ColecoVision. An inbox ColecoVision for $20, but it had no games, and – I want to buy stuff to want to play it, and if I'm not going to play it, I'm just going to get rid of it. So
yeah, that stuff's not really fun anyway.
It's a little bit too old. But Josh, you want to hit on that Street Fighter stuff?
Yeah, so Evo's going on this weekend, and for those of you who don't know, Evo is a big fighting game tournament that happens every July. It's been going on for quite a few years out in Las Vegas. And generally, Capcom has a big presence there because they are so well known for their fighting games historically. And I'm sure we'll be covering some of those in the coming months on Back in My Play, because those are such important games in the legacy of gaming. Anyway, those of you who played games back in the day, back in my play in the 90s, you certainly remember Capcom releasing and iterating on Street Fighter throughout the years. So you'd have Street Fighter, then Super Street Fighter, then Super Street Fighter Turbo, right? They would do all these different naming styles when they would add something new to the game, a couple of stages, a couple of players, some balance tweaks, things like that, because you couldn't patch games easily. You'd have to release a new cart back then. And they've been doing something kind of similar to it with Street Fighter 4, which has become the one that the fighting game community has really latched on to during this generation, the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 generation of consoles. Street Fighter 4 is sort of the de facto fighting game, not Street Fighter Cross Tekken or some of the other ones that have come about. So they've released Street Fighter 4, Super Street Fighter 4, Super Street Fighter 4 Arcade Edition, and word came out this weekend that there will be another Street Fighter update coming out that can be downloaded for $15 with 5 extra characters and 6 extra stages, as well as some tweaks. Or you can just buy a disc-based copy of it for $40. We don't know what the name is going to be as of recording time. There's a little internal debate that we have going on in the podcast that they might go with the Turbo moniker. Some people in GAF are saying maybe Super Street Fighter 4 : Final Fight. And the reason for that is because a couple of characters from Final Fight are finding their way. And I know that some are already in the game, but some new ones are finding their way into this game, including the much beloved Poison and Hugo, who also was in some of the, was in Third Strike, I believe. So at least in Street Fighter 3. So those of you who like beat 'em ups and like Final Fight, like yours truly, perhaps you should be excited for this, because we're going to get some more deep cuts. Some more of these guys from Final Fight are going to find their way into the Street Fighter franchise in 2014.
Super cool. Street Fighter is good.
Yes, it is.
Let's talk about our recommendations for this week. I'm going to kick it off because I have no idea what your recommendations are. And I am picking, coincidentally, Street Fighter Alpha 2 for the Super Nintendo, a crazy port, considering Street Fighter Alpha did not come out on the Super Nintendo. It was on the PS1 and Sega Saturn. And then somehow Street Fighter Alpha 2, which I used to own the CPS2 board for in my candy cab, but the port that they did for Super Nintendo was nothing short of, you know, amazing. It was nothing short of a really programming, it was programming magic where they were able to fit that game on a Super Nintendo cart. And there are things like loading, and it will not only load before you get into the match, but right after it says fight, it will continue to load for 2 seconds. So it's,
oh, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. So you go fight, pause, pause, then you start fighting. It was like, it was really that bad. And the music was pretty much spot on with like the CPS2 stuff. All the characters are in there and all the moves are in there, but the like the voice, like there was no room left on that cart. Like it was, I think it was the biggest Super Nintendo cart in terms of ROM size that they ever put out. But there was literally no room on it where the voices, like for Hadouken, like they sound like absolute shit. Like they sound terrible. Like it even, like if you compare to like Street Fighter 2 Turbo, where it sounds way better, there just wasn't room for high quality samples on there. But you know, I think that's.
But it's still a cool. It's cool that it came out at all, and that's actually on the Virtual Console for those of you who don't want to pick up the cart.
Well, yeah, the cart's like $15 on eBay. That's where I bought it last week on my hoarding or my binge of purchasing. But the you know, it plays great, and as someone that loves Street Fighter Alpha 2, the arcade version, it is really nice to still you know, pop that in and get in you know, some Street Fighter 2 whenever you are Street Fighter Alpha 2 whenever you want to, and it just adds on to the incredible list of Street Fighter games that are on the Super Nintendo that is pretty amazing. So, Josh, I hear you have some really good stuff this week.
Yeah, I bought a Sega Saturn last week. Nice. I scored a really nice deal on one. Half Price Books is a national U.S. chain. They're not paying me to say this. I wish they were, but they're not. It's in random states, random cities. It's definitely in Kentucky, I can tell you that much. They have really great prices on retro stuff. If you can find one of these anywhere near you, Half Price Books is the name of the store. And I got a Sega Saturn last week with a coupon for like 30 something bucks. It came with two controllers. They were the later controllers, you know, the really the not the ones that have the like pronounced grips, but the ones that people will buy for their PS3 now, you know, with a little USB port. So just that really awesome Saturn controller came with two of them. And right now I'm in the process of trying to find Saturn Bomberman. I want it so badly. But so far I've just settled on some of the easier to find games in the meantime. One of those, and you need to revisit it, is Daytona USA. That game is still a lot of fun to play, and it's really fun to go Daytona. So it's also fun to see all the pop-in as you're driving around. It's a very nice reminder that the Sega Saturn was not meant to do 3D very well.
I'm more of I would probably stick with the Dreamcast version.
Yeah, it's definitely, if you want to enjoy it, you should play the Dreamcast version.
But for nostalgia sake, you should go and get the Sega Saturn version, which that, I mean, that was like a pack-in when they were, the poor goddamn Sega Saturn, where they were packing that in with Virtual Cop 2 and Virtual Fighter 2, like yep. They were just trying everything they can to throw that thing into people's homes, and still no one bought it. And like I had my eye on a friggin' Sega Saturn forever at Funko Land, because you could get like the printout sheets from Funko Land with all the prices on it. And I would always try to like scheme of like, all right, man, I'm going to get a Sega Saturn. And I wanted Die Hard arcade game. Like that was the game that I needed to have because I had it at the mall. So I'm like, man, I need a Sega Saturn. I can get Die Hard arcade. I can get Virtual Cop 2 and a gun, and I can get Virtual Fighter like for $70. What can I trade in? That's going to be $70. But I just never pulled the trigger. And, I'm looking forward to like that's at the top of my list when I get to Japan. Sega Saturn, gotta have it.
Yeah, that great Saturn, concept. The Japanese Saturn is probably better looking also.
Right. It's a pearl white console, but I'm sure it's gonna yellow. Really gorgeous. Trey, what do you got? What are you playing this week? What do we got? Paperboy RPG?
No, not this week. Maybe later. Being that tonight is Money in the Bank pay-per-view, I'm going to recommend a wrestling game, but I'm going to go back a bit further. WWF WrestleMania, the arcade game.
Yes!
It was made by Midway. It actually came out on several systems. It came out...
Acclaim ported that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it was on the Sega Genesis, the 32X, the... Super Nintendo, and then
everything,
there was
man, they ported that shit, man. They ported
it,
that.
Yeah,
that
it was on awesome. Sega Saturn. It was on PlayStation.
Yeah.
What
version did you play, man, Trey? When you played it?
I had the Super Nintendo version, but I played the Genesis, which is vastly superior.
No
to the
way.
Super Nintendo version. Yeah, the Super Nintendo version actually cuts two of the wrestlers out.
What?
Yeah. In the Genesis version, you get Bam Bam Bigelow, Bret Hart, Doink the Clown, Lex Luger, Razor Ramon, Shawn Michaels, and The Undertaker, and then Yokozuna. Yeah, Yokozuna.
Man, what would like the Digital Foundry head to head look like for that game when we're comparing? You know,
yeah, seriously. The crazy thing about this one, you know, a lot of people, you know, talk about No Mercy. You know, the grapple based game. It's got the grappling and the strikes. This is more like Mortal Kombat. And it was a bit over the top. Undertaker could actually cast spirits at his opponents, and Doink the Clown could shock them with a like a little toy.
I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah, you know, it kind of fits with their characters, but you know, there were actual wrestling moves in there. You could do their finishing moves, and it's a little bit more over the top than, you know, your standard wrestling game. It was more fun arcadey type than it was simulation, which kind of fits with the name. But there was you know, you could do the head-to-head mode with friends, or there was a single player mode, which basically you could either go after the Intercontinental title or the WWF title, and it basically puts you in like a bunch of different matches. Like Intercontinental, I think you had to win a 3-on-1 handicap match to beat the mode. And then the WWF championship mode, you go through like a series of matches, and then at the very end, the last thing you do is you do a gauntlet. You fight all eight wrestlers back to back to back to back with one set of health. So it was really tough. Very, very, very tough game. But it's a lot of fun. It's real lighthearted. it came out, you know, you can kind of look at the cast of wrestlers, and if you're a fan of wrestling, you know, during the 90s, it wasn't really as good, because mostly everybody went to WCW, and their roster was kind of light. They had Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels were the two top guys for a long time. But it was a fun game. I remember playing a lot of it when I was a lot younger, and I was a big Shawn Michaels fan, so that's who I used to play as. And so, I would always beat up Doink because I'm deathly afraid of clowns. So,
so get it on the Genesis, though, is the moral of the story.
Yes, yes, okay. Definitely get it on Genesis, because the Super Nintendo does not have Bam Bam Bigelow and Yokozuna.
Or maybe the PS1 or Sega. Dude, get that for the Sega Saturn, Josh. Get on.
Oh, is it on Saturn?
Here's a fun fact, though. It came out on 32X, and I was just looking this up when I decided I was going to recommend it. It was on 32X. For whatever reason, the 32X version of the game had better graphics, but the frame rate was dropped to 30 instead of 60.
Yeah, because
but every other version of the game... Oh, is that why?
Yeah, the claim ports, like, their quality control across platforms was... I mean, it was just so weird like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, always choose 60 frames per second.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they put a ton of effort into the 32X version after they saw what, you know, the marketplace was for that thing.
And the PlayStation and Saturn versions have no music either. No
Jesus
in-game music.
Christ.
Yeah. Crazy.
All right, just, Wow. What you should do is you should go find your local arcade operator, find the PCB for it, and then get a Super Gun and hook that up to a TV and play the arcade version where it's real. Play the OG.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. All right. Trey, you win this week because that is a great recommendation. It makes I really want to freaking play that game right now. That game is so good. All right. So that's going to do it for this week's show. Next week, we're going to be playing Zombies Ate My Neighbors. And then we're also going to be going head to head. And you guys can somehow prove me wrong. We're going to be playing Final Fight.
Oh, yeah. In honor of the Street Fighter announcement.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we'll see. Until next time, as always, please subscribe through iTunes. And if you are listening and enjoying the show, I would be super, super – we would all be sleeping way better if you gave us a review on iTunes and rated us on there. It means a lot, and it helps get the word out. And also share the podcast with a friend. Tell your buddy that you used to play Super Nintendo with or used to play Sewer Shark on Sega CD with.
Whoa.
Share them the podcast, and you know, then you guys can kind of revisit these memories, and we'll help you get into the momentum of jumping on eBay, getting an old console, and hooking it up to an old TV you pick up on Craigslist. It is really fun to go back in time and you relive some of those memories. So, as always, a huge pleasure to do this show with Josh and Trey every single week. It's a ton of fun, and thank you guys out there for listening. And Trey and Josh, thanks so much for your time and, you know, reliving some old video game memories.
Had a blast.
Yeah, great time. Always.
All right, don't forget to check out backinmyplay.com as well, posting some great stuff on there and hopefully maybe doing some editorial stuff down the road. Who knows? Again, thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of the week. We'll see you next Sunday with a brand new episode of Back in My Play.
Later.
Bye.